From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. After years of advocacy and fighting through the legislature and the courts, Illinois finally ended cash bond in September. Now people accused of crimes can no longer be held before trial simply because they don't have access to a pile of cash. Instead, prosecutors and defense attorneys are meant to argue it out before judges, who will decide whether someone is likely to be a danger to their community. It's still early days for the new law, but one thing we know for certain about the old system is that it disproportionately affected Black and Latino communities. Not only did Black and Latino men get hit with bond amounts that were higher than white men, we know that from a federal study from last year, but it was often their family members who had to scrape together savings to get their children and siblings and parents and spouses out of jail. And that, the effect this change is having on communities of color, is the subject of the first part of our show today. Joining us for that discussion is Brianna Payton. She's the Associate Director of Policy and Advocacy for the Chicago Appleseed Center for Fair Courts. She's with us today to talk about the new law and how it's affected communities of color in the past and what the future may hold. Brianna, welcome to the 21st Show.
Thank you so much for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. Madeline Baer is Policy Director for the Chicago Alliance Against Sexual Exploitation. She's done public policy advocacy for more than 5 years and support for survivors of rape and survivors of sexual assault trafficking. Madeline, welcome. Thank you for being here as well.
Thanks so much for having me.
And I should say, we were hoping to bring you the voice of someone who has actually had relatively recent experience with being incarcerated while awaiting trial, a trial on which this individual was ultimately found not guilty. We have had challenges connecting with them. We are going to continue trying that today and hopefully bring that important voice into our conversation. For now, if you want to join us, maybe you have seen firsthand some of the problems that the old system had. Maybe you had a positive experience with the old system. Let us know. We want to hear your perspective. 800-222-9455 is the number. 800-222-9455. And if you just have questions about this change and what we've been seeing in Illinois since the end of cash bail, almost 2 months ago now, 800-222-9455. All right, Brianna, I want to begin with you, and let's just talk about the old system, how it worked. Walk us through what someone would experience, you know, from their bond hearing on.
Yes, absolutely. So under the old system, if someone was accused of a crime and arrested, many times they would go before a judge for a bond hearing. And at that hearing, the judge would have a few options before them. One, they could release someone on their own recognizance, also known as an I-bond. That's a non-financial release where someone does not have to pay money and they just have to agree to return to court and to not get rearrested while they are awaiting trial. That's the most lenient, kind of least restrictive option. And the judge can also choose conditions if they decide to release someone on their own recognizance. The most restrictive and severe response is that if a judge determined that they believe someone was not safe to be released, that they posed a risk to others or to the community, or they posed a risk of not returning for court, then they could deny someone bond and then they would be jailed before trial. But under the old system, Those two options exist under the new system, but under the old system, there was this third murky middle ground option, which was money bond. It was the judge saying, well, you can be released, but only if you can pay this amount of money. And so it was kind of a bait and switch because your outcome about whether you were released ultimately depended on whether you had access to whatever amount of money the judge somewhat arbitrarily decided to put on your case. Judges were using money bonds to oftentimes set amounts that were specifically unaffordable for people, even though by law, money bonds are supposed to be in amounts that people could afford to pay. And so it was being used as a tool to incarcerate people before trial without their due process rights.
Do you think there was a path to justice under the old system, under the money bond system? I mean, was there a certain fairness to it in some ways?
Absolutely not. There, it was actually a grave injustice. It was one and continues to be in other states, one of the most glaring injustices in our entire criminal legal system, because you're blatantly treating people differently and based on whether they are rich or whether they are poor, and not just poor, but unable to drop, you know, hundreds to thousands of dollars at a moment's notice to pay for their freedom. It was actually a horrible lingering remnant that kind of reminds you of our old slavery system, where people had to pay money to purchase their freedom. And so it's doubly bad that this was disproportionately affecting Black families and tearing Black families apart through pretrial incarceration. So no, there was not a good path to justice. People could sometimes go to the judge and ask if they would reconsider the money bond. Sometimes they would, sometimes they wouldn't. Sometimes they'd leave it the same amount. Sometimes they'd lower it and it still might not be affordable, because there's no such thing as an affordable money bond. I have personally heard from a woman who sat in jail for months on a $100 bond because nobody, she didn't have it and nobody was coming to pay it to get her out. And she talked about how it made her feel like her freedom wasn't worth $100. And so there's no such thing as an affordable money bond. And there's also no such thing as a definitely unaffordable money bond, because we've seen judges set amounts in the millions and people still are able to sometimes pay it and get out. And so it's just ultimately a gamble with our safety, and it's a gamble with people's pretrial freedom. And it was fundamentally unfair and unjust.
Madeline Baer, I want to bring you into the conversation now. You have worked with survivors of sexual assault and rape. Under the old system, were their voices heard in court? Were they part of the consideration?
That's a great question, Ryan. I mean, no, survivors really have not had a voice under our former system, and it didn't keep survivors safe, just as Brianna articulated really well. People could get out of jail simply because they had the money to pay, not whether they were a danger to the survivor or the public. We've seen that in some of our cases as well, as judges set really high bonds thinking, oh, this will be a way to keep someone incarcerated if they are in fact a danger. And we would see people bail out because they had the wealth. Whereas in comparison, just as Brianna gave that example of the woman with the $100 bond who's incarcerated for months, it really was a system that was not predicated on any sort of safety, but really on wealth.
How has that changed with the new system?
Yeah, I mean, there's been many changes, particularly around victims' rights and notification to victims. So some of the things that are new, starting on September 18th, is that survivors now have the right to timely notification before any initial hearing and detention hearing. So previously, these hearings were exempt under the law from victims being notified of, or formerly bond hearings. So now being able to get that notice from the state's attorney's office that this hearing is coming up, to being able to communicate with the state's attorney's office about whether they would like that person incarcerated or not, or just being able to share their story better. This time and this notice gives survivors a better opportunity to safety plan. Some other changes are that survivors can also choose if they want to participate in a risk assessment interview, something that they were previously prohibited from doing. And the Pretrial Fairness Act also entitles survivors to more opportunities to file protective orders at each court date. Survivors have always been able to file protective orders in cases of stalking, sexual assault, or domestic violence. But now the law requires that state's attorneys provide notice to victims at every single hearing that you have the ability to petition for a protective order at every single court date. So we anticipate a lot of survivors using that remedy as well.
Madeline, this change was painted by its political opponents as pro-criminal. Working with survivors or victims, how did people in your world feel about this change?
People were largely very supportive in the victim advocacy community. I mean, it's one of the reasons that we were so supportive, is not only is money bond a glaring injustice in our community and in our state, but also it wasn't providing safety for survivors. That was something that when I talk with advocates at conferences or other things where we present about what Illinois has done, advocates across the country are nodding their heads like, yes, this is not keeping survivors safe. This is a system that is really based on wealth. It's not keeping survivors in the know. It's not giving them any sort of stability or opportunity to converse with state's attorneys and police officers about what this case is going to look like for them. So people in our community have been really in support of this.
If you're just joining us, this is the 21st show. We are speaking about Illinois' new law going on 2 months now since it finally took effect, although it passed a long time ago and faced a long challenge in the courts. I should say the Pretrial Fairness Act is what it's called, part of the Safety Act that ends cash bail or cash bond here in Illinois. We're talking about this and particularly the way that old system disproportionately affected communities of color. We're talking with Brianna Payton, who is Associate Director of Policy and Advocacy for the Chicago Appleseed Center for Fair Courts. Also, Madeline Baer, Policy Director with the Chicago Alliance Against Sexual Exploitation. If you want to join our conversation today, it's 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. All right, Brianna, let's dive into that topic of how cash bond disproportionately affected Black and brown communities in Illinois and really nationally for that matter. Say more about that.
Absolutely. Like any other part of the criminal legal system, money bond was disproportionately harming Black and Latine communities. Black people in particular were the most likely to be given a high unaffordable money bond, and due to the racial wealth gap, the least likely to be able to pay it. So that leads to being the least likely to be released from jail before trial, even if they have the same charges or background as maybe their white counterparts.
Advocates would often say that it sort of criminalized poverty. Can you say more about that?
It absolutely criminalized poverty, because if you look at two people that have the exact same set of charges and the exact same background, but you give them both the exact same money bond, but one can get out as long as they can pay it and the other one can't. That is the definition of criminalizing exactly poverty. We've isolated every other variable, and in the money bond system, the one thing standing between someone's pretrial freedom or pretrial incarceration is access to wealth. It is the most blatant criminalization of poverty that probably exists in our entire entire country's set of policies and systems.
You know, Madeline, one of the arguments that advocates made is that decreasing pretrial incarceration would actually improve community safety. And I think that probably sounds counterintuitive to some people. Why do you think that is? Say more about that argument.
Yeah, there's a few different things at play here, Brian. So first, because we have created a system that is going to be more thorough in looking at cases that are potentially a risk to public safety, what it means is our court is going to be, and our law enforcement, are not going to be having to spend as much time on cases that don't rise to that level. So a lot of cases, you're very low level misdemeanors and petty offenses, those folks are never going to make it into bond court, which means they're likely to not be incarcerated. So what that means is we have judges and prosecutors and law enforcement who get to spend much more time preparing, investigating, and interviewing victims on cases that are a risk to the public safety. There was kind of an estimation done by Loyola that about 80% of the cases in Cook County bond court right now, or I should say formerly prior to September 18th, a lot of those cases, about 80% or so that would have gone through bond court, would likely not be going through bond court anymore under our new system, which means we get 100% of their time on 20% kind of more higher level cases that we want to assess for public safety. So that to me is a big thing in thinking about kind of the judicial economy of the court system. What do we really want our law enforcement and court actor to be spending time on? We don't want them to be spending time on cases that are kind of low level, cases that are not a risk of public safety. The other thing is that extracting wealth from communities does create a lot of public safety issues. People cannot afford housing or childcare or keep up with their work. All of the things that we tell people to do to avoid, interacting with the criminal legal system, or we tell people to do after they reenter the community after incarceration, get a job, find housing, take care of your family. By extracting wealth from communities that are impacted by this, it creates a lot of harm because people simply can't do what we tell people to do. So extracting wealth in that way has been a huge safety issue. And I just wanted to highlight the efficiency of our system now under this new system without money bond.
Brianna, I know you want to weigh in on this. What do you have to say about what we've been talking about?
Absolutely. I echo everything that Madeline shared. even though we have been taught that incarceration inherently makes us safer, we're often not told how it perpetuates and worsens cycles of trauma and violence in people's lives. It often spits people out in a lot worse condition than they went in, and it destabilizes individual lives, which translates to families and translates to our community. So I absolutely echo that. And the data has shown that, you know, reducing the use of money bond and increasing pretrial release has not had a negative effect on crime rates, court appearance rates, recidivism rates, and the like, and that actually pretrial incarceration has statistically been shown to increase the likelihood of rearrest in the future, even if all other factors are the same in terms of charges and background. But the one thing that I did want to also clarify from Madeline's point about the new system and what is going through bond court is that when we talk about, you know, 80% of cases not being going through bond court, it's not that they won't have any hearing. It is that they will not necessarily all be detention eligible if they don't have an open case, but they will still have a first appearance hearing where they will be heard by a judge, and the judge will have the opportunity to determine what set of pretrial conditions will most promote their safety, the safety of the community, and their success pretrial, whether that be check-ins, monitoring of different sorts, things of that nature. And so there's still attention being paid to every case, but in terms of considering eligibility for being actually put in jail before trial, which is a very severe response, that is being reserved for the more serious cases.
All right, we need to take a break. We are going to continue this conversation in about 2 minutes. We've got, I see you on the phone lines. Stay with us, please. We want to get to your call when we come back. If you want to join us, 800-222-9455 is the number. That's 800-222-9455. More about the end of cash bond in Illinois when we return. This is the 21st Show. Please stay with us. This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking about the end of cash bond in Illinois, which happened back in September, finally, after years of legislative and court fights over this change in Illinois law. Now somebody who is incarcerated awaiting trial can only really be incarcerated because they present a danger or a judge makes that determination. Can't simply be as it was under the old system because they couldn't scrape the money together to post their bond. We're talking about this change with Brianna Payton, who is Associate Director of Policy and Advocacy at the Chicago Appleseed Center for Fair Courts, and Madeline Baer, Policy Director at the Chicago Alliance Against Sexual Exploitation. If you want to join our conversation today, 800-222-9455 is the number, 800-222-9455. And let's go now to Marcia, who is calling in from Winnebago County in northern Illinois. Marcia, thank you for calling in.
Sure. Cash bond was not only finances, but it was a tool for prosecutors in the state to use to bludgeon defendants into submission. In 2008, I had about the highest cash bond in Winnebago County, even though I had no priors, was nonviolent, and was not a flight risk. I had an assessed bond of $200,000, and I had to pay $60,000 in order to get out of jail. In reality, they never expected me to make my bond, but I was able to do so. But it impoverished me and has impoverished me to this day. It cost me my job. It cost me my security. It cost me my pension. It cost me my medical coverage, my credit, my reputation, everything. I lost all my property. I had to short sale my house, et cetera, just to survive. But in reality, they did this all knowing that I was innocent. They falsified evidence against me because a suspect in a high-profile case, they didn't have evidence on him, so they wanted to keep me in jail in hopes that I would basically turn on him and falsely testify or confess or implicate him in some way or another. And that did not work, but again, it took me 7 years to work myself out of the mess.
7 years to work yourself out, and $60,000. How, I mean, if you don't want to go into detail, that's fine. I appreciate you calling in, but how does one scrape together $60,000?
You have to borrow by any means possible. I ended up spending about 10 years taking care of my parents, who were both bedridden with dementia 24/7 as their only caregiver during the time I was going through this prosecution as well, just because I did no longer, you know, I was deprived of the means to handle or assist them financially in other ways.
And in your view, the prosecutors were using this as you said, a bludgeon, not because you were a flight risk or going to go out
That's
and
right.
hurt people.
I was what's termed collateral damage. Hmm. They didn't care about the welfare of myself or my family. All they cared about was accruing whatever evidence they could against the other suspect, who in the end, really, they couldn't find any evidence against that person either.
And Marcia, you said you're still dealing with the effects of this, even though it started in 2008.
Yes, because they cost me just about my financial future. I was not at an age where I could go back and recoup my losses through additional work wages and so forth. So now I'm dealing with a much reduced income, barely scraping by.
Do you think, have you followed this change in the law? Is that something that you think is a positive thing that Illinois is doing?
Oh, yeah, it's definitely needed. From my time in jail, you know, perhaps maybe 5% of the individuals in there should have been in there. In reality, we put people in jail that we just don't want to deal with, whether they, you know, act out a little bit socially or don't have the best behaviors, whatever. We just incarcerate them, put them out of our minds. And that's what I found in jail. Jail was not a safety factor. Most of the people in there, like I say, should not have been in jail. We're in there for relatively minor offenses.
You know, one of our guests is wondering if, Brianna, if you just want to ask your question, go ahead. Yeah.
Yes, Marcia, thank you so much for calling in and sharing your experience. I'm so sorry that this happened to you. I was wondering, it sounds like you never got your $60,000 back, and I'm wondering if you can share whether that's the case, because you're supposed to get your money back at the end of the case. But we did find in research that in 80% of cases, people don't get their money back, and I'm wondering if that's what happened to you.
Well, I'm a very persistent person, so yes, I did get most of my money back. But by statute, though, the state was allowed to, or the county was still allowed to retain 10% of whatever bond amount it was, whether you were guilty or found innocent at the end. So in reality, I mean, the county still has like $6,000 on my money. I feel like I paid almost for the use of one courtroom.
Hmm. Brianna, Marcia, let me just say thank you so much for calling in and sharing your experience with us today. I very much appreciate
Sure.
your time. Brianna, do you want to take it where you will, responding to what you heard from Marcia there?
Absolutely. I, again, am so sorry for what happened to Marcia, and I can just confirm that this story, while uniquely tragic, is not uncommon. There are so many people that can tell you so many things that they and their family lost due to these unaffordable money bonds that are essentially holding people for ransom in jail. You know, one person told me who had disabilities said that their family had to like take out a second mortgage on their house. There are people that have, you know, refinanced large purchases in order to get their loved ones out of jail. People will go to great lengths to get their loved ones or themselves out of jail, because jail is such a torturous place where people's mental health, physical health, and very lives are at risk daily. And people every year go into jails, sometimes on unaffordable money bonds, and do not make it out alive. And that is not an understatement. The suicide rate in jails is 3 times that of the general population. It's even higher than it is in prisons, because some people say jail is even worse than prison in a lot of ways. And so people will go through a lot in order to get out, but just because they're able to scrape the money together and get out doesn't mean that it doesn't end up ruining their lives in so many other ways, like Marcia said.
Madeline, I wonder if you want to respond to anything we heard from Marcia as well.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for calling in, Marcia, and sharing your story. And I'm so sorry that this happened. I mean, what I really wanted to add to that is opponents of this new system and of the Pretrial Fairness Act have repeatedly said that this system is anti-victim. This is going to be so harmful for public safety. But hearing Marcia's story just really reiterates what about our former system kept us safe? Is this really a good use of resources by law enforcement and our court system? Because what actually makes us safe is them spending appropriate time and resources to address harm done against victims of sexual harm, of domestic violence, taking their time to make sure that these cases are done well and using their resources in an appropriate and equitable manner. The way that Marcia is describing this, this is not a system that we ever wanted to uphold. So it just really confirms that, you know, the system that we're creating now, that we're embarking on, is really just a really strong path forward. And I'm excited about what the system is going to look like for so many folks.
This is the 21st show. We are talking about the end of cash bond here in Illinois. It's been about 2 months since that system went into effect. We've been talking about a number of the disproportionate effects that the old system had, particularly in Black and Latina communities. We are talking about this all with Madeline Baer, who is policy director at the Chicago Alliance Against Sexual Exploitation, and Brianna Payton, who's associate director of policy and advocacy at the Chicago Appleseed Center for Fair Courts. 800-222-9455 if you want to join our conversation today. 800-222-9455. You know, Madeline, you're verging into one of my favorite subjects. I mean, that's sort of a weird way to say it, but in the criminal justice space, which is the idea of, you know, maybe the problem is we're prosecuting the wrong crimes, right? The state is sort of, if you want to get philosophical about it, giving up its monopoly on violence. It's letting too many people get away with sort of the very severe crimes of murder and things like that, and focusing more on these petty things. What do you think about that? Where should we be directing our energy?
I also love this question, Brian. So I sat in an initial hearings court in Cook County a few weeks ago, and the cases that were coming through, you know, were driving with a suspended license, possession of marijuana, and like a large amount of, you know, a larger amount of marijuana, to be clear, given that it's legalized here. But these were the kinds of cases that were popping up in an initial appearance court. And it was clear that there was a lot of time and effort and resources put into addressing these cases. And the thing I keep coming back to in watching court and watching this play out over the last few weeks and over the last few years in our past system is a research report we did back in 2020 in Chicago, which found that of, you know, over the past decade or so, of the reports of sexual assault that came in towards the Chicago Police Department, less than 10 to 20% of those reports led to an arrest. So I'm sitting here frequently hearing that this new system is going to be harmful for victims. You know, you name it, we've heard it from opponents of this new system. And yet we are routinely seeing survivors turned away by law enforcement, not believed by law enforcement, and not seeing progress move forward in their cases. And yet an entire court hearing day at initial appearance court in Cook County was focused on cases like possession of controlled substances and driving with suspended license. So it just reiterates, how do we want to spend our court and law enforcement resources? We should be spending them on trying to ensure that people who have caused harm and people who are seeking justice through the criminal legal system actually get kind of the justice that they are looking for. If we are telling survivors to routinely go to this system, and that system doesn't support them, what does that say about our society and our resources? So it's just really something we think a lot about, is our equitable resources and our limited resources and how we want to be spending them.
You know, Brianna, something we haven't talked about yet is how incarceration before a trial for someone who, again, is accused of a crime but not yet convicted of it, how does that affect their opportunity for getting a fair trial? Do we know that? Do they have a better? Go ahead. Yeah.
Absolutely. It has a devastating impact on someone's ability to build, to mount their legal defense. I mean, think about it. When you are in jail, it is that much harder to communicate with your attorney. You can't just pick up your phone and talk to them at any given time. You are using phones that you're sharing amongst other people. You're using phones where you do not have privacy. I have literally heard a prosecutor in this past week tell me that they listen to all the calls in the jail. And so you don't have privacy speaking to your attorney. You don't have the ability to just speak with them as much as you want. It's harder for you to help with gathering evidence and contacting witnesses. And so you have an attorney that is having to do a lot of these things on the outside while their client is on the inside and unable to support them. And imagine, you know, if someone's lawyer is reaching out to you to try to get you to help them in a case, as opposed to you being able to talk to that person directly. You know, most of us don't even pick up the phone for unfamiliar numbers. And so just imagine, you know, someone's attorney having to do the work of trying to build this case on the outside without the help of their client. And then, as Marcia said, pretrial incarceration is a tool used by prosecutors. And this is truly why a lot of prosecutors opposed the Pretrial Fairness Act. It is a tool that they use to get people to plead guilty without going to trial. Despite the fact that everyone is guaranteed a trial, our criminal legal system would utterly crumble if everyone actually used their right to a trial. So what the system does is it coerces people into pleading guilty without going to trial, often using the tool of pretrial incarceration, telling people, hey, if you plead guilty to this, then I will only ask for you to get this much time. You will be able to get out either immediately or in this, you know, shortened amount of time or predictable amount of time, instead of waiting for a trial to play out, which can take another 1 to 2 years. And so people often just want to end the misery and the disillusion of everything in their lives that's happening while they're incarcerated pretrial. And so they may take a plea deal that they wouldn't have otherwise if they had the ability to fight their case while retaining their pretrial freedom. And the statistics bear this out. People with the same background and the same charges, people are 3 times more likely to get a prison sentence, twice as likely to get a jail sentence, multiple times more likely prison and jail sentences. Everything in the case outcomes are worse when pretrial incarceration is in the mix, and that is by design.
Just a few minutes left in our time together. Madeline, we've talked about some of the changes you think would be helpful, or maybe the sort of even big picture compass direction of the justice system. But thinking more concretely, this end of cash bond was a big step. Advocates have been pushing for it for a long time, but it's still just a step. Madeline, where do you think the system needs to go?
I mean, the biggest thing we're focused on right now, Brian, is implementation, right? So this is a new system. This is a very big ship that we're having to steer, so to speak, in Illinois. The reality is, I mean, the human nature of our system, it's going to be flawed in some way. So we have to constantly be on top of how is this system working and are they following the law appropriately and correctly? I mean, judges and law enforcement and prosecutors and defense attorneys have been making these kinds of decisions for a long time. But now we have to really look at it with a much more careful evaluation of each case. So we're really looking at making sure that we have the staffing to make sure that victim notification occurs, right? Victims are entitled to these kinds of notification, but if we don't have enough staff in the victim witness units of different prosecutors' offices, is that going to happen correctly? These are the kinds of things that we're really trying to spend time and effort on and making sure that we get right, and that counties have the budgets and the staffing available to make sure that we can enforce this law correctly.
Brianna, probably our last question, about a minute and a half left. What's next? Where do you think the system needs to go now?
Oh, wow. I mean, there are so many directions that the system needs to go in terms of continuing to rectify and mitigate injustices in our criminal legal system. But I can at least touch on some of our concerns when it comes to implementation. It's really important that Illinois not expand the use of pretrial electronic monitoring. This is another form of incarceration that is often popular, especially when someone is released before trial, but it does a lot of the same harms to people that incarceration in a brick and mortar jail does, in terms of making it hard for them to work, making it hard for them to take care of themselves, making it hard for them to just function in their lives. And similarly to jail, it doesn't show any positive impact on court appearance rates or safety or recidivism rates. And it, in some cases, especially in the cases when it's used with people who are low risk, shows opposite effect, that it increases the likelihood of further entanglement in the legal system. So we really want to make sure that that's something that, rather than expanding under this new system, is actually something that is reduced. Because in Illinois, we currently, in Cook County alone, have the largest pretrial electronic monitoring program in the country. And so that's something that I think is another big front on the fight for pretrial justice.
Brianna Payton is the Associate Director for Policy and Advocacy with the Chicago Appleseed Center for Fair Courts. Madeline Baer is Policy Director for Chicago Alliance Against Sexual Exploitation. Thank you both so much for being with us today on the 21st Show.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, we're going to be talking about Midwestern identity. We want to hear from you. Do you think of yourself as a Midwesterner? How far do the boundaries of the Midwest stretch? Let us know by sending an email to talk@21stshow.org, talk@21stshow.org. More to come after a short break. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us.